This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Slip a bookmark into your paperback and listen to KBOO for interviews with your favorite fiction and nonfiction writers. Between the Covers airs Thursdays from 11 to 11:30 a.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender justice, and more. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll go to Florida to speak with Representative Anna Escamani, a progressive lawmaker who's working to rebuild her state after Hurricane Ian's climate change-fueled devastation. Then we'll take a look at Brazil's election, where former President Lula won the first round and now heads to a runoff against far-right incumbent Jair Bolsonaro. My guest will be Maria Luisa Mendonça, director of Brazil's Network for Social Justice and Human Rights. Finally, we'll go to Italy to speak with writer and educator Michael Leonardi, who will explain why Italy just elected a neo-fascist leader, Giorgia Meloni, with the aid of the American far right. That's coming up in just a moment.
We'll be right back.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Florida's latest death toll from Hurricane Ian is 103 and likely to keep rising. The hurricane was one of the strongest to ever make landfall in the United States, bringing catastrophic flooding, cutting off coastal islands from the mainland, electrical power to millions of residents, and causing nearly $50 billion of damage. Meanwhile, Governor Ron DeSantis, who as a congressman in 2013 had voted against federal aid to New York victims of Hurricane Sandy, is now petitioning Washington, D.C. for aid to his state. DeSantis has generally avoided discussing how a changing climate fuels stronger hurricanes, and in the past had dismissed climate change as, quote, left-wing stuff. He also faces legal trouble with his recent political stunt involving trafficking migrants from Texas to Massachusetts. We turn now to Representative Ana V. Escamani, who is a member of the Florida House of Representatives representing District 47. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, give us a sense of how severe the devastation is. For those of us, you know, I'm here on the West Coast. It's hard to imagine. So far, we've heard that 103 people have been killed, but I imagine that that's a severe underestimate. Can you give us a sense of how this compares to hurricane season in the past?
I mean, it's clear to us those are getting stronger and stronger, and the impact is more deadly. Many folks have referenced Hurricane Ian to be Florida's Katrina. The impact in Southwest Florida is absolutely devastating. Excuse me, I also am recovering from a cold right now. So the impact has been absolutely devastating in Southwest Florida. We also saw intense flooding in the greater Orlando area. In fact, parts of my district were just completely flooded. Folks were locked in their homes, could not get out. We're very worried about the fatality rate continuing to increase. And indeed, we're also talking about many communities who have already been negatively impacted, whether it's by the pandemic or facing financial insecurity, now being in more dire circumstances.
So one of the things that I know that you have pointed out in your work is that when you have crises like this, the state needs to put a moratorium on evictions, for example. I mean, already there are people being displaced, but then to have them be displaced because of artificial reasons like being unable to pay the rent, how is that figuring in as Florida's recovering?
It is such a great question, and one of my biggest concerns right now is that you have this first storm of Hurricane Ian, but you also have the second storm. All these additional variables and economic crises, and they're already seeing, especially in Lee County, many Floridians who are fearful of eviction, some who applied for rental assistance from the county program but are no longer receiving updates because understandably, the county resources have shifted towards search and response and trying to get power back on and help folks who are now in shelter who've lost their homes. And so for those who still have a place to live, they're also potentially facing displacement if we don't look at policies that can stop the bleeding in different parts of this disaster response. So we have made the request of the governor's office to pursue an eviction moratorium on impacted areas that have a disaster declaration. We've also been talking to our Lee County legislative colleagues and really encouraging them to do the same, because again, this will be a ripple effect. And we already know that folks have been severely displaced and others have lost their lives. And we want to prevent this disaster from impacting others. And that means getting very, very proactive in addressing some of these second tier crises that can evolve from the first one.
How are you assessing Governor Ron DeSantis's leadership? He has asked for federal aid. I mentioned in my introduction that in 2013, when he was a congressman, he voted against federal aid to the victims of Hurricane Sandy in New York, saying that, you know, that they need, he feels for the victims, but they need to stand on their own 2 feet. Here he is leading a state that is so devastated that he has no choice but to ask for aid.
Well, it's very ironic because Governor Ron DeSantis fiercely attacked President Biden while also accepting money from the federal administration. particular, Florida has benefited greatly from CARES Act funding. We have benefited greatly from American Rescue Plan money. Oftentimes when DeSantis talks about our budget surplus, it's only because of American Rescue Plan money. In fact, the latest tax break on gas that DeSantis has been cheering about was paid for by American Rescue Plan money. 40% of Florida's state budget is federally funded. We are a state that receives and accepts a great deal of money from the Fed. So it's very ironic to see DeSantis proactively request the money, but at the same time, unexpected, because he already accepts billions of dollars in federal money despite his rhetoric and despite his voting track record. There's already been criticism around the evacuation timeline for Lee County, where officials are being accused of delaying that evacuation to the point where it was too late for people to leave. I am very concerned that the rhetoric around the term mandatory, because it is now connected to the pandemic and to having to take public health actions like mask wearing or vaccines, that conservatives are hesitant to mandate things. But in the case of a hurricane and of evacuation, mandates are necessary at times of crisis. And so there is a concern that the county officials waited too late. Others have been defending that, along including DeSantis. But I'm very hopeful that the response to Hurricane Ian will not be partisan. But we're already seeing, for example, the Secretary of State, Cord Byrd, in visiting counties and deciding how to move forward with the November election, knowing that populations have been impacted, the counties he is visiting are red counties and he's not visiting more blue counties. So I am very concerned that there seems to be a preference in how the state is responding. And we're going to continue to call that out because has been impacted by Hurricane Ian, of different political backgrounds, generations, economic experiences. And we need an equitable response, one that doesn't leave anyone behind. And we need to make sure that this is not partisan, that it's very much focused on what's best for Florida.
What about the issue of climate change? I mean, this is very clear that the hurricanes have become stronger as a result of climate change. Ron DeSantis has dismissed tackling climate change as left-wing stuff. And he's also failed to make Florida resilient, because Florida is already hurricane prone. Now with climate change, you have stronger hurricanes. So it's harder to weather the storms, literally speaking. How do you see the state's leadership and the governor's leadership in particular on the issue of climate change?
It is non-existent. And in fact, I have been the leading voice on setting renewable energy goals, on setting energy efficiency goals, in expanding rooftop solar and battery storage. In fact, this past legislative session, the legislature tried to slow down the growth of rooftop solar to benefit utility companies. And in fact, when you try to challenge Republicans on climate change in the context of property insurance, they also ignore it as a real issue. But here's the reality. Storms have gotten much stronger. Storms require warm water to strengthen. And so as temperatures rise and sea level rise, there's going to be more warm water for these storms to benefit from. And in fact, one of the worst hurricanes in Florida history that folks remember vividly is Charley. But Charley, though, had similar wind strength compared to this hurricane. It was nowhere close to the size. This was a huge storm that impacted every part of our state. We saw tornadoes pop up in South Florida, flooding all the way to the East Coast, storm surges that were several feet high and absolutely devastating to those who are impacted. And this will continue to happen if we do not take climate change seriously and build up our resiliency. And that does also mean reconsidering the construction of new development in these environmentally vulnerable locations. We know sea level is rising, so you cannot pretend as if it's the same situation of 40, 50, 60 years ago. Not only do we have new data to help us make informed decisions, but we have resources and technology and so many new construction, architectural styles that we can pursue to make our building safer and more sustainable long term. But it's very frustrating because this is not championed by the current administration and definitely not by Governor DeSantis.
There were millions of homes that lost electricity. There's still, as of this recording, hundreds of thousands that remain without power. Did the limited amount of renewable energy that is there in Florida prove itself during this hurricane? Did we see proof that green energy sources, solar in particular, can help make communities resilient in times like this?
Absolutely. I mean, Babcock Ranch is a very good example. This is a planned solar community that did not suffer the same fate of others and really experienced complete access to power during most of the storm. We also have seen individual homeowners use their electric vehicles as battery storage and basically use it as a means to charge up their homes for several days. Now, remember, even if you have solar panels, unless you have battery storage or some sort of decentralized battery storage available to you, you're still stuck on the grid. And when the grid is off, you're off. So it does further emphasize the need for more battery storage. But we do
see... Just to clarify that, you can have solar panels, but the power you generate, generally speaking, most states have this set up. I think California, most cities rather have this set up. The power you generate goes back into the grid and then you draw out of the grid, which unfortunately centralizes the power, but then it is also more equitable. But battery storage can make the difference in times of crisis.
Yes, well said. I mean, the other issue too is that you cannot put power back on the grid if there are people working on the grid, because it could be dangerous to them. And so that's why expanding battery storage and also decentralizing parts of the grid, allowing for there to be energy zones, for example, can really help to ensure greater sustainability during these times of crisis, or even having public buildings be solar-based with battery storage so that those buildings can serve as locations that are energized and providing food, water, and charging stations alongside internet access. And so there are so many more solutions that we can approach, and having solar on the ground already available can be a game changer in crisis response, especially in the case of hurricanes in Florida.
How has DeSantis's leadership and Republican leadership in Florida also led economic deregulation in a way that is going to be hurting Floridians? You mentioned the insurance industry. Is that an example?
Yes. I mean, Florida has one of the highest property insurance rates in the country. And we also have to remember that many Floridians who are impacted by Hurricane Ian do not have flood insurance. And so they will be leaning on FEMA for support. And of course, that's going to be, you know, the greater public paying for damages in our state, because we do not have a governor that prioritizes these types of issues. Now, with that said, the high cost of property insurance has also been tied to many companies just leaving the state. And so your options and the competition between different companies becomes more and more limited. And this is in large part due to the Florida legislature ignoring the problem. You know, Governor DeSantis, instead of prioritizing address these economic issues during the regular session, instead attacked immigrants, banned abortion, attacked LGBTQ plus kids, erased Black history. I mean, those were the issues that took up all the time during session. We had to have a special session and come back to Tallahassee in May to address property insurance. And the bill that my colleagues passed, we were a bill sponsor who is connected to the insurance company, that we might not see relief for 18 months, if ever. It was basically a bailout for insurance companies and has not resulted in rates going down compared to what financial benefits insurance companies got out of it. And I would say one of the biggest immediate solutions we could pursue right now in Florida is expanding what's called the CAT fund, or the catastrophic fund. This essentially serves as a reinsurance option for insurance companies so that we can at least eliminate the passing down of reinsurance to consumers. And of course, one of the largest insurance actors in the country and a well-known name, State Farm, is one of the lobby forces against this, because State Farm is also in the reinsurance business. Hmm. So it's pretty frustrating because we have solutions, but they're just not pursued because our legislative Republican leaders would rather continuously pivot blame towards trial attorneys and just ignore the responsibility of these insurance companies who are excessively denying people their claims. And so it's a wicked problem. It's not easy to solve. We do have some solutions in front of us that just are not pursued.
And then you mentioned that Governor DeSantis was paying attention more to demonizing immigrants. He is in legal trouble right now for the role that he played in what's basically considered a trafficking scheme, paying millions of dollars to fly undocumented immigrants from Texas to Massachusetts. How is that being viewed by Floridians? I can only imagine how difficult that must be and how disgusted some folks must be to see their governor getting involved in something. They weren't even, people from his state. They weren't immigrants in his state. He flew them out of one different state into another different state just days before the hurricane hit.
Yeah, it's incredibly gross. It's unethical and as you noted, potentially illegal with criminal and civil charges to wait for. Myself, Representative Dottie Joseph, and a handful of other state lawmakers have sent letters to both Department of Transportation and Department of Justice asking for investigations. We are very concerned about the civil rights of those that were tricked and lured into these planes, alongside concerns of trafficking, and even going up against the Civil Rights Act, which says you cannot use public money or federal money to discriminate, which is exactly what was done, with Governor DeSantis himself admitting that individuals were profiled to be Venezuelan. And again, these are folks who are fleeing oppressive governments in other countries trying to seek refuge in the United States. And the fact that he went to a different state to do this is even more insidious. It also speaks to the fact that he continuously uses public money to campaign for president while ignoring problems that are happening in our state.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Anna, for joining us today. Best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Anna V. Escamani, who is a state lawmaker in Florida in the State House of Representatives representing District 47. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Brazilians went to the polls on October 2nd in an election that was widely expected to bring clear-cut victory to former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who until recently had been imprisoned on trumped-up corruption charges. But the incumbent, Jair Bolsonaro, had a better than expected showing. The final outcome of Lula's 48.4% to Bolsonaro's 43.2% means that the two will be matched up in a runoff election on October 30th. Bolsonaro's far-right party also had a far stronger showing in the lower house of Congress than expected, increasing its seats from 76 to 99. We turn to Maria Luisa Mendonça, director of Brazil's Network for Social Justice and Human Rights and a visiting scholar at the CUNY Graduate Center in New York. Welcome to the program, Maria Luisa.
Thank you very much.
So what was expected to happen in these elections ahead of Sunday? The polls were showing that Lula might outright win. And if he had gotten 50% plus one vote, he would have won, right?
Yes, exactly. But in any case, it's very difficult for a president, a sitting president, not to win most votes, even in the first round. So I think in spite of all of this, Lula did well. He had 6 million votes more than Bolsonaro. But of course, it was disappointing because since Bolsonaro has been threatening not to accept the result of the elections, his discourse is very similar to Trump's discourse, and he spreads, you know, fear and violence. So, you know, the hope was that Lula could win in the first round to avoid the risk of Bolsonaro threats to democracy. But, you know, we still have 3 weeks to go. We have a second round. Lula got, you know, many more votes than Bolsonaro. And now also the hope is that the smaller parties that got a smaller percentage of the votes would support Lula. So we are hoping that very soon those parties would announce that they would support Lula, so Lula would be able to build a broader alliance for the second.
We've spoken to you many times in the past around what was happening in Brazil with Bolsonaro's rule. During the pandemic, he dismissed the COVID-19 virus. He's been a far-right leader who's really pushed back a lot of Brazil's reforms under Lula. And Lula has been the victim of political charges. So what traced the rise for our audience for Lula from prison to nearly president? How did he get pardoned? How was it that he was allowed to run?
Yes, exactly. We talked about that before. You have been following this process since 2016, when President Dilma Rousseff, at that time, there was a parliamentary coup against her. And then after that, Lula was arrested, although...
And Rousseff was an ally of Lula's.
Exactly, yeah. President Dilma Rousseff was also with the Workers' Party, and in 2016, she suffered a parliamentary coup. You know, the right-wing forces in the country orchestrated a parliamentary coup against her. And then later, former President Lula was also charged with corruption, although there was no evidence against him. So the only way Bolsonaro was able to take power was because there was that parliamentary coup against former President Dilma Rousseff in 2016. And then Lula was not able to run in the last election. So that was the context in which Bolsonaro took power. So the only way right-wing parties in Brazil were able to take power in recent decades was because they orchestrated a coup, and, you know, the series of attacks on the Workers' Party. But now, you know, after a very, you know, disastrous administration of Bolsonaro, Lula, again, you know, is the most popular politician in the country.
So when we, when you were observing what was happening in the lead up to the election, what were the issues at stake? Bolsonaro's, you know, he'd been very popular. He's still, I think, more popular than most people hoped he would be. How has he been able to deflect or counter some of the claims and some of the very real damage that his government did? I mean, is he, you know, how have him and Lula tackled issues in the lead up to the election?
Yeah, it's difficult to understand, you know, how Bolsonaro has that type of popularity. But I think, first of all, we had years and years of attacks against the Workers' Party, almost like, imagine if all mainstream media were like Fox News. So basically, you know, people were bombarded with attacks against the Workers' Party. In addition to that, Bolsonaro mounted a huge infrastructure to spread fake news on social media. And actually, the Supreme Court in Brazil is investigating, there is a current investigation against Bolsonaro's party for spreading fake news, including, you know, fake news discrediting the elections and discrediting democracy. In addition to that, Bolsonaro has support from the evangelical church in Brazil. So if you put together, you know, all of this infrastructure in favor of Bolsonaro, the message is very strong. So the challenge is how, you know, you resist that type of message. But I think most Brazilians now still know that the Workers' Party had very concrete policies to improve the lives of people. You know, most people in the country want policies that that prioritize investments in education, in healthcare, to protect the environment, to protect women's rights. So, you know, that is, I think that this idea that the country is polarized doesn't really explain that there was this orchestrated effort to attack democracy in Brazil. So Bolsonaro is part of this global far-right movement that uses those types of mechanisms to manipulate public opinion and to discredit democracy.
What about the issue of climate change? Brazil has, you know, huge chunk of the Amazon rainforest is in Brazil, and Bolsonaro was responsible for allowing the Amazon to be decimated and, of course, angering indigenous communities there. Did those issues play a part in the election?
Yes, that's for sure. And it's also important to have international solidarity because, of course, environmental issues and climate change are global issues. So you probably remember a couple of years ago, there was a lot of attention to the huge fires in the Amazon. And Bolsonaro was responsible for that because he dismantled all the environmental institutions in the country, including the environmental ministry. And also his rhetoric gave incentives for mining corporations, agribusiness to expand the destruction of the Amazon. But although we don't see that very much in the news right now, deforestation actually increased in the recent years. Last year and this year so far, deforestation is larger than last year and the year before. So, but we also need to point to the role of foreign corporations, agribusiness corporations, mining corporations that are also promoting the destruction of the Amazon. And we need to build solidarity and to denounce that internationally as well.
Now, when we look at the next 3 weeks, where the runoff election, where Lula and Bolsonaro alone face off against one another, what does Lula need to do? If you read the sort of corporate press, it's really interesting because for a long time, Lula was dismissed as a corrupt left winger who was too far left. Bolsonaro was sort of tolerated. But now you're seeing outlets like The Economist, for example, realizing that Bolsonaro is bad for Brazil and suggesting that Lula needs to move to the center in order to win. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that the mainstream conservative parties took a big risk since the parliamentary coup in 2016, supporting that coup and then supporting Bolsonaro, even though sometimes they didn't support directly. They created the context for Bolsonaro and this far-right neo-fascist movement to take power in Brazil. And in terms of the results of the elections for Congress, for example, the left-wing parties didn't lose seats. The major loss was by the mainstream conservative parties that lost space to this extreme far-right movement that Bolsonaro represents. So, you know, mainstream media internationally in Brazil, and also, let's say, the more mainstream neoliberal conservative parties need to understand that they took a big risk. And now they're losing space. They're almost irrelevant in Brazil right now. So I think Lula needs to move forward with the message that makes sense for Brazilians. You know, they need to improve, the Workers' Party needs to improve the lives of people, you know, having economic policies that create jobs, that protect the environment.
So you don't think he needs to move to the center, that he should actually stick to his principles? That's what people love him for.
I don't think that investing in education and healthcare and job creation is a radical idea. I don't think Lula is this radical left-wing right. person, you know. I think he is a moderate politician. The problem is now, you know, that you have as a reference a far-right neo-fascist movement. So I don't think Lula is radical at all.
So compared to Bolsonaro, he seems radical, but really, as you're right, I mean, even before Bolsonaro came into power, there was some on the left who really were disappointed that he wasn't left enough, that Lula wasn't left enough.
Exactly, yeah. Many social movements had criticisms of the Workers' Party before, because they thought, you know, they could move to make structural changes in Brazil, for example, implement agrarian reform, you know, have policies that would be more structural policies. But, you know, even though we there was some criticism, we think that the amount of investment that the Workers' Party did in education, for example, was unprecedented. So it was, you know, they really made concrete improvements in the lives of people. And that's why people still support Lula. That's why he's the most popular politician in the country, because people remember that there was a concrete change to improve the lives of people. So I think all of us need to support that, need to support, you know, better economic policies and social policies.
Well, we'll certainly see what happens in the next few weeks. Maria Luisa, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your analysis as always.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Maria Luisa Mendonça, Director of Brazil's Network for Social Justice and Human Rights and visiting scholar at the CUNY Graduate Center in New York. We've been talking about Brazil's first round of elections, which took place Sunday and yielded a win for Lula, who didn't win 50% outright, and so heads to a runoff against Bolsonaro on October 30th. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com. By becoming a subscriber, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. Thank you. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Italians will soon get their first ever woman prime minister, Giorgia Meloni. Meloni's rise to power, however, may be a serious setback for the rights of women, as well as immigrants, the LGBTQ community, the environment, and more. Her far-right Brotherhood of Italy party is seen as a descendant of fascist leader Silvio Berlusconi and even Mussolini. She's also considered to be a strong ally of former U.S. President Donald Trump's advisor, Steve Bannon. In an op-ed for Counterpunch, writer Michael Leonardi says Meloni's popularity is, quote, based on her fiery rhetoric and sloganeering, feeding on the spiraling discontent of an increasingly ignorant populace. Michael Leonardi is an activist, educator, and contributor to Counterpunch. He joins me now from Italy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sonali. Pleasure to be here.
So first, let's talk about how she came to power within Italy before we get to the role that Americans in the far right have played. She's a very young person to not just be a politician, but especially to be a leader, the top leader in this nation. How did she get there?
Well, Meloni's had an interesting rise to the political limelight and the leadership of the Brotherhood of Italy party, the Fratelli d'Italia. She grew out of the youth fascist movement in Italy. She was a proud leader of fascist youth organization in her high school days. Starting at the age of 15, she rose to a leadership role in the fascist youth brigades, and she's always been proud of this, never shied away from it. And then joined helped lead the Fratelli d'Italia party, and came to win this last election with not a mandate, I would say, but enough of a percentage of the vote in a coalition with other right-wing parties to be elected what will soon be the prime minister of Italy, first female prime minister of Italy.
Right. I should say that she hasn't yet been named as of this recording. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that Americans sometimes have a hard time getting used to. We don't have a parliamentary system like many nations do. And so you don't directly elect a prime minister. Your parties choose, the parties that win elections, form coalitions, and then choose a leader. It's similar to the system in the United Kingdom. So Meloni is also somebody who has been very open, hasn't she, about her agenda. What is her agenda? And you don't pull any punches when you explain it in your article in Counterpunch, where you describe that she has, you know, risen, I believe it was, used the word slime, risen like a toxic slime on the surface of a sea of contaminated waste. What are her politics?
Her politics are based in xenophobia, racism, the scapegoating of immigrants for trying to shift blame to the immigrant population for economic hardships that are on the rise, definitely in Italy. And that line there, like a toxic slime rising to the surface of a sea of contaminated waste, I'm referring to the rest of the Italian political spectrum, because the left, kind of the so-called left, the center left, they say, left a vacuum in leadership. They didn't really stand for anything. I kind of compare them a lot of times to the Democratic Party of the United States, not really taking a strong stand for workers' rights, human rights, just kind of nonchalantly following along with the most recent government in Italy has been under the leadership of Mario Draghi, who is a technocrat, appointed technocrat, who was formerly the president of the European Central Bank. So he had very neoliberal policies focused on free markets, and so kind of left a vacuum in leadership. They didn't do well with the populace. The people here are frustrated. There's growing tension, growing economic hardship. Electricity bills, utility rates, have gone up more than 150% just in the last year. So can you imagine the impact that's having on families that are working just to make ends meet? All of a sudden, they have this massive rise in utility bills, and it's causing inflation across the board in the Italian economy. So people are frustrated. They don't see any real political leadership. These last Italian elections had the lowest voter turnout in history. And so this gave the opportunity for the extreme right, fascist right, to rise to the top. And as you said, we're in a parliamentary system here. So Meloni's Brotherhood of Italy is in a coalition with Lega, which used to be Lega Nord, which is a xenophobic party, also based on the scapegoating of immigrants and a very nationalistic Italians first sloganeerings, very similar to Trump's kind of sloganeering with America first. This same sort of language, right, that we're seeing not only in Italy but across Europe and across the world. This they call sovereignist movement, this nationalistic sovereignist movement. So she's in coalition with Lega, and also with Berlusconi, who's still around. I think he's 86 years old now and becoming a little bit more incoherent in his old age, but he still leads the Forza Italia party. So those three parties combined managed to get enough of the majority, and her party the largest majority to allow her to become the first prime minister. Now, I want to say that at the Venice Film Festival that was a little over a month ago, Hillary Clinton was in attendance at that at the Venice Film Festival, and was asked by a journalist from Corriere della Sera, which is the one of the most important daily newspapers in Italy, what she thought of the possibility of Giorgia Meloni becoming the first woman prime minister of Italy. And she said that she thought it was a positive thing, that any time a woman is elected to a position of power, it's a step forward for women around the world. Unfortunately, I disagree with Hillary Clinton on that. Meloni is anti-abortion. She's very anti-LGBTQ rights. So Italy has recognized civil unions, but not gone so far as to recognize gay marriage, but there's a push for that here. And they have legalized adoptions for the LGBTQ community, and she's threatened to reverse that, okay, and to reverse adoptions that have already been recognized by the state as being illegitimate. This is part of the rhetoric that she used on the campaign trail over the last 2 years.
I want to just hone in on this pattern that we see emerging, where comparisons to the United States are quite appropriate. You have the neoliberal party that seems to think investing in identity politics alone will be a path to power, while of course doing very little to further social justice, economic justice, that ends up causing so much discontent and apathy among, and lack of enthusiasm among the populace, that it opens the door for the far right, for fascist elements to take root. And so you see that leaders like Trump and Meloni end up being the product of both the far right and the failure of the liberal wings of the political parties. Is that a fair assessment?
I'd say that's it. That's it in a nutshell. That's what we've seen. We almost saw it again, even with the last election in the United States. And we saw it. I've been a Green for decades. I was involved with the original workings of the Green Party in the United States, where I'm originally from, and I supported Bernie Sanders' campaigns in the last two general elections, and I thought it kind of was a travesty the way the Democratic machine hindered him from being the. I thought he was on his way to being the rightful nominee in the last campaign, and then all of a sudden, from one day to the next, Biden comes from the kind of the bottom of the pack, and he's ordained the next president. And so he gave lip service to a lot of the the sort of Occupy movement, Bernie Sanders' campaign around inequality and social justice. But then when it comes down to implementing policy, we see very little progressive policy being implemented. One of the issues, immigration is a big issue here in Italy. Many immigrants are attempting always to get in across the Mediterranean, and usually around 2,000 drown at sea a year in a perilous attempt to make it to the shores of Southern Europe, and Italy being southernmost is a destination a lot of the times. And just as it is with the southern border in the United States, the horrible conditions that we see continuing with no transformative change happening from the Biden administration, and seeing actually a continuation of many of Trump's policies at the border. So yeah, it's a frustrating situation I feel across the world. And I also think that there's a role that the United States has played in Italy, even since the end of World War II, that's been very instrumental in allowing.
Right, let's talk about that. You trace that in your article on Counterpunch. The most recent connection is that between Meloni and Steve Bannon. But let's go much further than that. How did the United States, with some cooperation from other European nations, squash progressive leaning movements in Italy?
Italy is an important country strategically because it's a peninsula right in the Mediterranean, pointing in the direction of Middle East resources. And during World War II, when Mussolini was the leader of Italy, there was the fascist Italy, right, in alliance with Nazi Germany. The Italian people, there was an uprising in Italy against the fascist regime, led by what were called the partisans or the partigiani, and they were communists, and they were in villages, towns, and cities across the country fighting back an insurrection from within against fascist rule. And then came the United States in with Allied bombing campaigns, which they took credit for liberating Italy. But there's another story that there was an insurrection from within to liberate Italy going on simultaneously to the United States coming in. So and then eventually that insurrection won. I mean, Mussolini was hung upside down in a public square after being executed by the partigiani that had liberated the country from Mussolini's rule. He wasn't captured and killed by the U.S. Allied forces. He was captured and killed by the communist partisans, okay? And at the end of World War II, the Communist Party was the most popular party in Italy. And so there was a threat to the United States geopolitical interests that Italy could become part of the Soviet bloc or the Russian-influenced sphere of Eastern Europe, right? And the United States, after World War II, spent $10 million, which was a heck of a lot of money at that time. We're talking about 1947 and 48. $10 million to influence the Italian election to defeat the communists and put in a very U.S.-friendly government called the Democratic Christians, Democracia Cristiana, that was the Democratic Christians to defeat the communists. And so the United States' role, according to historians that have looked at it since World War II, has been to keep Italy in a state of destabilization with kind of a rotating door of governments, really ever since World War II, to keep Italy unstable on a governmental level so that the United States can continue to do business as usual within the country. And Italy is dotted with U.S. military bases. The war in Libya, for example, was the command and control center was run out of Italy. The United States has nuclear weapons in Italy on a military base in the north of Italy called Aviano. So if there was ever to be a nuclear conflict in this geopolitical part of the world, it's very likely if the United States was to use a nuclear weapon, it would come from Italy, which puts Italy in a very uncomfortable position during this current war going on in the Ukraine, where it seems the pundits out there and our political leadership are trying to normalize the idea of a nuclear war. Like, oh, it's so, recently it was said by someone that if Ukraine were to be attacked by nuclear weapons by Russia, that they would hunker down and fight back even more fierce than they're fighting back now. It seems absurd to me to think that it's like reducing the effects of what a nuclear armed conflict really means, wiping out the memory of what Nagasaki and Hiroshima looked like after they were bombed, right? It's insanity, it seems like to me.
So today, lay out for us as well the links between the rise of neo-fascism in the United States and that in Italy. What does Steve Bannon have to do with Giorgia Meloni?
So Steve Bannon was going around Europe trying to unify these sovereign forces over the latter part of the last decade into 2020. I believe he's is he in prison now? He was arrested recently, I know. But I read an article yesterday kind of researching the back history of this, and this was an article from 2020 that said Bannon's goal to unite the sovereignists and the nationalists across Europe was failing. But this election of Giorgia Meloni here, Orban in power in Hungary, the far right in power in Poland, a far right extremist party having the possibility to actually win the next election in Spain called the Vox Party, Marie Le Pen in France being the second largest party in France and just waiting in the wings because Macron's this is his last time to be elected, and there's a vacuum in leadership on the so-called left in France, so she's just waiting in the wings. And just in the last period in Sweden, there was also an election, and it was shocking there that the far right did extremely well and came in second place in Sweden. So really, this failure of Bannon to, and they are united, these nationalist sovereignist movements. The first person to call Meloni after she was won the election was Orban, and the second person was the president of Poland, whose name's escaping me at the moment. So there is this unification, and Bannon did go around Europe. They held training sessions and conventions together, launching this, what they called this new Christian crusade in Europe to preserve what they wrap in this rhetoric of family values and this kind of white identity racist kind of politics, the same type of politics we saw glaringly rise to the surface during the Trump years. This same agenda is being pushed throughout Europe.
Well, Michael, we'll certainly would love to touch base with you again once Meloni comes to power, and we'll see what her agenda actually unfolds into. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck to you.
I appreciate being on, and I look forward to talking to you again, because right now it's a big question mark.
Right.
What's really actually going to happen with her government?
Thank you. My guest has been Michael Leonardi, joining me from Italy. He's an educator and activist and a contributor to Counterpunch. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at @RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Ketsam. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Hey, Michael here. I'm with the Tin Can Phone Podcast.